Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. On this edition, in Syria, the Damascus Chamber of Commerce says the interim government pledges to open up the economy, but will businesses that left finally now go back? Also, the man charged with the murder of a US health insurance boss fights his extradition in court, and there's confusion over who's in charge in South Korea. What could that mean for the country's economy? But let's start by taking you to Syria, where there are signs of economic life now restarting. Cafes and shops have begun to reopen, and staff at the central bank have been seen returning to work. Let's bring you some voices from the Syrian capital. Firstly, here's the BBC's Sally Nabil.
We are here in central Damascus, and life has just started to go back to normal. Over the past couple of days, and right after the downfall of Bashar al-Assad, all these shops around us were closed. People were scared. Now, the shops are open, people are going back shopping, a lot of restaurants and local coffee shops are working. Yes, there is a night curfew in place at the moment, but it's more or less business as usual now. There is a strong sense of relief among locals here. I remember one man telling me, the fear is now gone. The interim government seems to have a long to-do list waiting. People here want everything. They want better living conditions, democracy, freedom, transparency. I noticed that many families came from outside Damascus to look for their loved ones who disappeared over the past decade.
I came to look for my nephew, who has been a political prisoner for 12 years. He was taken away in a car. We checked hospitals and prisons and couldn't find him.
Now we can breathe much easier, and we're hoping for better days. The regime was pressuring us. They refused to set us free. We were under pressure.
Now we can talk freely, and we fear nothing anymore. Under Assad, we used to say, even the wall has ears.
Since the downfall of Bashar al-Assad, celebrations haven't stopped here in central Damascus. Some people told us they still couldn't believe that this authority has gone. They still couldn't believe that they are about to start a new chapter in the history of this country.
It is such a seminal moment for Syria and also for the Middle East that we want to spend some time on World Business Report today, trying to get a sense of what's happening economically in the country. And as we heard from Sally there, people are returning to work. Let's hear some of those voices now. Jude was working in a chocolate shop.
In the past, things seemed normal, but there was always this sense of suffocation. People now greet each other with good morning, whereas before, it didn't feel like a genuine good morning. Back then, everyone who came to the shop was either there to represent a general or a minister loyal to the Assad regime.
Nasser works in a supermarket.
We can finally feel the warmth of the sun again. Now everything has a distinct smell and taste. We had been subjected to extreme oppression, so much so that we would whisper to each other even during ordinary conversations. But now, our minds are at ease, and the cycle of life has resumed.
Really a sense of relief coming out from the voices that we've been hearing there. But plenty of Syrians are worried about the new administration with the Islamist Hayat Tahrir al-Sham or HTS group at its helm. The BBC's Jeremy Bowen spoke to some of those trying to get out of the country as he crossed into Syria at the border with Lebanon.
Talking to a couple of the guys who are trying to get their families out here, there are probably a few thousand people. Now, tell me, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham?
Very bad.
Why? Less? Why?
Kill people,
kill women, kill Muslims, Shia, kill everybody.
Jolani?
Yes, not Jolani.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham.
The people with Jolani.
So there we go, different voices, some of them glad to see the country returning to some sort of normality economically, others they're worried about their future and leaving the country. We always encourage you to get in touch with us. And Mariam Aflehem is a Syrian journalist in Damascus writing for aljumhuriyah.net. She sent us this voice note from the
Our
capital.
Lives in the past were tragic and miserable because of the poverty, fear and injustice that we experienced every day. But today, I feel like I was born again, and I feel a lot of freedom and optimism. I woke up every day and see people still celebrating that this criminal is gone. Gradually, the situation is improving. People are still afraid of their next steps and don't take up any new business activity. But Syria today needs people who are politically active, educated, and have the motivation and passion to build a new homeland after all these losses.
Let's pick up on the point that Maram was talking about there. How do you build a new Syrian economy? Fadi Dayoub is the head of a Syrian NGO which is trying to help people restart economic activity in their local areas. He's currently living in France. He started by telling me how hard it was to do business whilst President Assad was in power.
It is a big challenge. You have to understand that Syrian society has been hit by a rocket, which is called the Assad family, for the last 50 years. It had an impact not only on the economy, but on the people themselves, the way people think. And business also was hit because, especially in the, just prior to the revolution in 2011, the regime kind of shifted to economical interests. So if you wanted to do business in Syria and you want to grow very big, you had to be part of the game. If you exceed a certain amount, you have to pay fees or even make parts of the royal family part of your business, whether you like it or not.
That is the picture of what it was like. Now yes. That regime has gone, we yes. are hearing about businesses reopening, cafes reopening. Yes. What are you hearing in terms of from within the business community in Syria? It's very early days, but are we seeing things happening economically that we haven't seen before?
It's really too soon to tell. I think the business community is looking for this change, but it's too early to say because now we have a new ruler actually in town. So they probably would be in a let's wait and see actually prior to changing their minds. And lots of businesses actually moved away from Syria to neighboring countries. And these might be the first ones to come back if the environment is better.
Now, that is the big question, isn't it? How do you persuade people to come back? And from the conversations that you're having with people, are there many who are prepared to take those steps?
Yes, on an emotional level, yes, definitely. Lots of people are actually very enthusiastic about what's happening and they are motivated to go back. But again, we are still in the kind of euphoria of the all of the regime, but we're still not in the level of people making really concrete decisions about, especially businesses. Don't forget that Syria is still under sanctions. So the business environment is not very easy. These need to change. I think the major thing that we need in Syria is confidence.
Can I ask you about the infrastructure in parts of Syria? And it is different from region to region, but there are parts of it that have been almost completely destroyed. That needs to be rebuilt for business to function as well, doesn't it?
It does. Also, you have a loss of human capital. You know, we have to relaunch education because you need skills. You've lost lots of skilled people that actually immigrated from the country. You need them to go back also. The infrastructure is not only the kind of physical infrastructure. You need a legal infrastructure. You need a social infrastructure that actually would support the businesses. What we need is a complete process of building a new country, actually. We have also opportunities. The Syrian diaspora is huge. What they have to see is probably a vision, confidence, where they can actually either come back and contribute or send money to contribute.
You know, when you talk about this, you talk about the brain drain. You clearly are part of that brain drain. As you sit there now, are you thinking of going back and rebuilding your life there?
Definitely. I'm closer to my age of retirement than the young generations. So yeah, definitely. It is also important to see what would be the reaction of the young generations that have left Syria. This generation can be helpful because they are young, they have the energy.
And yourself, you know, you said you may go back. What would make you definitively go back and help to try and rebuild the country?
I'm married. I have children. So it's a family decision. It's not only my own. But even if we cannot do a complete resettlement inside of Syria, there are ways where actually I can also contribute even physically by going there very often and actually trying to help. This is a model for me. If I would have been a little bit younger, I think the decision would have been very, very clear to go back.
We've talked a lot about rebuilding the economy. To do that, It also needs capital, doesn't it, to come into the country. Do you see that happening? Do you think from within the Syrian community and from outside as well?
There are two folds of that. One is international assistance. But to be honest with you, I would rather us Syrians build our new country using our own resources. I think the estimate of number of families outside of Syria, we're talking about millions of families that are around the world for a country that has probably less than 20 million people inside of it. So little money from somebody outside of Syria is a lot of money for somebody inside of Syria. So I do believe if we can create this dream, then I'm very much confident that we can rely extensively on the diaspora.
And as that economy rebuilds, what will it be based on? Is it oil? Will it be agriculture? What do you think is the bedrock of the new economic future of the country?
There will be a little bit of oil, definitely. Agriculture is a part of our economy. Services is a big part of our economy. I don't want us to build a country where we are consumers of others' production, whether it's in economy or culture or social changes. I do feel that we have this potential. After what has happened the last 72 hours, my confidence in the Syrian people has grown even bigger.
Fadi Dayoub there. And during the course of the week, we will continue to bring you voices from Syria as it tries to rebuild its economy. The man charged with the murder of a health executive in New York has appeared in court in Pennsylvania for an extradition hearing. Luigi Maggioni struggled with officers as he arrived at the courthouse and shouted out at a group of photographers.
And completely out of touch and an insult to the intelligence of the American people and collective experience.
His bail has been denied. Thomas Maronic is a lawyer who worked for 20 years for a radio station in Maryland owned by the Maggioni family. What did he think when he heard that Luigi had been arrested in connection with the shooting?
When I first heard about it, I saw the last name and I was just shocked because I initially couldn't believe it was the same family that I had known and had been on their station for 20 years. And then I saw it was in fact a relative. I couldn't believe it. The family is very well respected. This is an esteemed family from Baltimore County, which is a larger suburb of Baltimore City in Maryland. They are known for their businesses, which include not only WCBM radio station, but also healthcare, retirement facilities, and they're tremendous donors to charitable causes.
Thomas Maronic there. Our correspondent, Nada Tafiq, has been following all the developments from New York.
He is contesting that extradition. And that is a key question. Why is he contesting that? I mean, I've spoken to defense lawyers, including one, Jeffrey Lichtman, who represented the drug lord El Chapo and others in state courts as well as federal. And he said for defense lawyers, typically, you know, you do want your client with you as soon as possible to start building a defense case. And I think it's understood that he will eventually be extradited to New York. He could have done that if he waived his right today, even. He could have been arriving here shortly, but that could take now a couple weeks, given Luigi Maggioni is contesting it. So really interesting because we saw an outburst in court where his lawyer actually told him to be quiet. What I heard from Jeffrey Lichtman, again, this defense lawyer I was speaking to, was that he thinks he may have a viable extreme emotional disturbance defense in New York, which would help lower, for example, a charge of murder to manslaughter and would lead to a much lower sentence. But that is going to be a key focus, of course, of his defense lawyers, how to build their kind of case moving forward.
Nada Tafiq reporting there. Let's have a look at some of the other business stories. Ayoka Yoshioka, Senior Portfolio Manager, Wealth Enhancement Group, is with us. We get big inflation numbers. Well, we don't know how big they are, but important inflation numbers, don't we, on Wednesday in the US? How are the markets reacting to those figures coming out?
Yes, in anticipation of tomorrow's CPI number, markets were, you know, down a little bit. They are down 0.3% today.
They are indeed. Let's look at a couple of company stories. General Motors to stop funding its Cruise robo-taxi business. Is that a bit of a surprise for them, do you think, Ayoka?
A little bit, but you know, the markets are celebrating this with an after-hours move of over 3% for GM, and GM is up close to 46% so far this year. So strong numbers out of GM stock. But I think this is going to help from a cost perspective for GM.
Yeah, let's see what happens there. Now, well, the company we've probably talked as much about as anybody else in 2024 is Boeing. They've obviously had production problems after those strikes, but a better day for them today.
Yes, absolutely. Boeing stock closed up 4.5% today on reports that it's restarted its production on the 737 MAX, its most popular product.
Okay, stay with us. We're going to talk about another big tech company a little bit later in the program. Remember, you can get in touch with us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033 if you're in Syria or have an interest in the country. Do let us know what you think its economic future is going to be and how it needs to be rebuilt. We had that voice note, didn't we, earlier in the program? You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. The political crisis in South Korea is deepening, with the president's office now announcing that it's unable to say who's actually running the country. Just take a minute to digest that statement. The chaos began when President Yoon briefly imposed martial law last week. He apologized, but he's refusing to resign. Already concerned investors are withdrawing from South Korea's stock markets. Prolonged instability could exacerbate the economic damage. Let's get the thoughts of Han Kyo-yu, former trade minister of South Korea. He's now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
This is unprecedented, a very, very unfortunate circumstance. Last Saturday, the impeachment failed, but the opposition party will try again this Saturday. And then looks like the dynamics inside the ruling party seems to be a bit changing now. And right now, at least 8 members in the ruling party needs to kind of shift their positions. And now, at least 3 ruling party members openly announced that they will vote in favor of the impeachment. And then it looks like that atmosphere seems to be spreading. So we'll see what happens this Saturday.
We'll see. But moving away from the political side of stuff and looking at the economic side of it, there needs to be some sort of resolution, doesn't there? Because if you're looking to invest in South Korea at the moment, if you're looking to go even on holiday, maybe with the uncertainty that we're seeing, that will put people off.
Yes, absolutely. I think this protracted political turmoil is beginning to affect the economy. You know, as you mentioned, the consumption seems to be weakening. Inbound travel is being affected. Some of those travels are being canceled, and also social gathering, dinner parties, etc., are being canceled. And also, it seriously is affecting investor confidence. So many businesses cannot really make investment decisions under this current political uncertainty.
That is not helpful, because the South Korean economy has struggled this year, hasn't it? It's not been the year they hoped for.
Yes, Korean economy is at a critical juncture. Obviously, this structural reform is needed. For example, semiconductor industry, this National Assembly was kind of mulling over the special legislation to provide the incentive tax and etc. to really boost up the semiconductor competitiveness. But it is stalled right now. Also, this steel industry and the chemical industry under huge stress and going through corporate restructuring because of this flooding chip export from China. But this corporate restructuring is also getting delayed. So yes, we need to bring this political stability as soon as possible.
Do you see an end to this political instability in South Korea in the next few weeks, or could this drag on for even longer?
I think that this is a very difficult situation. The most important thing is to really reflect the will of Korean people and, you know, bring normality and certainty into this political scene. I think the impeachment vote seems to be important, because if that happens, that in a way provides some certainty about what's next step. And then at least by next springtime, Korean people could expect some sort of a newly mandate, the new government coming in.
You talk about the impeachment vote. It may not happen. The problem is, if it doesn't go through, President Yoon will probably stay until February and March. That's a long period of instability, isn't it?
That's right. But I think the Korean people are outraged and frustrated and embarrassed. And the opposition party, they pledged that they will try this impeachment vote until it passes. So yes, the ruling party could boycott one or two or three vote, but I think the will of the Korean people will get stronger and stronger. And without reflecting those common will of Korean people, I think the ruling party may get in bigger trouble.
Yeah, we're going to keep a close eye on Asia's fourth largest economy, the country's former trade minister there. Let's turn to the world of tech now.
Alphabet shares are higher after announcing a quantum computing breakthrough, unveiling its new chip, Willow, which can perform a milestone.
Yeah, as we heard there, Google has built a computing chip called Willow. It takes just 5 minutes to complete tasks that some of the world's fastest conventional computers could complete in 10 septillion years. If you want to know what it is, that's a 1 and 25 zeros. Try and work that one out. But what is the use of it? John Preskill is an American theoretical physicist and the Richard P. Feynman Professor of Theoretical Physics. Here's what he told me about Willow.
We hope that quantum computers will be able to solve problems, run applications, which surpass by far what we can do with conventional computers today. But that's not the case yet. We have small-scale quantum computers now, but they can't really run commercially viable applications. And the reason is that they make too many mistakes. And we think the long-run solution to that difficulty will be what we call quantum error correction, which is a way of making quantum computers more robust, less prone to error, but at a cost. We would have to have much larger devices than we have now to make use of quantum error correction, that is, many more what we call qubits, which are the analog of bits in a quantum computer. And what Google has done is they've shown something that we'd been hoping to see for a long time. In fact, the theory behind this goes back to the 1990s. But they've shown that they can suppress errors in a quantum processor using this concept of quantum error correction. And that as they increase the number of physical qubits in the device, they get better and better protection against error.
When we're talking then about this new chip, is it able to do things a lot more quickly and correctly than we've seen before? And how much more quickly?
Well, it can't really do anything useful yet. Really, all they have is one well-protected qubit, the analog of a bit. And you can't do a computation with just one qubit. You'll have to have many. Now, they've also tried to run applications without using quantum error correction, using this device. It has 105 qubits. And they make the case that they can solve problems with the device far faster than we could with conventional computers. But these are not problems of any practical interest. They're problems which they chose to solve, applications they ran just for the purpose of benchmarking the device. But their estimate is that to emulate what their quantum processor has done with the most powerful supercomputers that currently exist would take much longer than the age of the universe.
So from what you're saying, whilst this is important conceptually, in terms of commercially, we're a long way from it being able to do things like that.
I think that's correct. I think the technology has gotten to the stage where it's quite interesting to scientists. We can explore the way complicated quantum systems behave in ways that we couldn't before, and that can lead to commercial applications down the road. But we're not sure how long it's going to take.
Go on, give us a guess. I mean, are we talking in the next 50 years?
Yeah, I would say 20 years is a reasonable estimate for substantial impact.
We're clearly some way from this being commercially valuable, but the fact that so many big companies like Google are investing in it does seem to show that they think at some point this could be worth a lot of money for them.
I think that's right. The big question is, what's the time scale? And the truth is, we don't really know. But unless we make ambitious attempts to advance the technology, it's never going to happen. So it's a good thing that the companies and also various research groups, national labs, and so on, are investing in deeper understanding and better hardware for using this quantum technology. That will make it happen faster.
Will it need a lot more power? Is that going to become an issue, do you think, in terms of the amount of electricity it will take?
It's a potential issue, but I don't think the power requirements will be nearly as large as for advances in AI, where the power we need is really extremely daunting.
John Preskill there. Ayoka's still with us. Google really pushing forward here on quantum computing, and it could be an area that adds a lot of money to the company, doesn't it?
In the long term, I think so. And, you know, the stock was up over 5% today, and it really sort of reflects, that technological innovation is still sort of alive and well at Google.
Yeah. And is that, do you think it has driven the markets in 2024, hasn't it? The whole tech side. Do you think that'll continue in 2025?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the focus on AI has really taken hold in 2024. Google lost a little share, at least mind share maybe, with ChatGPT. But I think having these types of announcements regarding quantum computing can be very beneficial for Google.
Ayoka, thank you for all your contributions once again here on World Business Report. We'll be back with Business Matters at 0100. GMT. We're going to be in Mexico and Singapore, and we're going to be talking quite a lot about the Chinese economy.